customary in some circles for the groom to present the bride with an engagement ring and to present it to her publicly. So, and if you want a description of what these affairs looked like, read Gorek and Schachter, the biography of Mordechai Kaplan, in which he describes some of the sordid aspects of the American rabbinate of the 20s and the 30s, how rabbis in those days were virtually ambulance chasers, and they went to engagement parties hoping they would be invited to be in the Seder Kiddushin or whatever, whatever the story is there. But that's the only sociological description of these affairs that I have seen, at least in print, and the whatever they're describing is a historical anomaly. But in any event, Rabbi Henkin was quite correctly concerned that this may very, very well create Kiddushin. Choshishin v'sablonos, and he has the agency of soil, kind of a warning that people shouldn't do these things, at least not in public with aiding, because you may end up with a valid kiddushin. Now the Sephardim, I don't know if it's still prevalent in any significant Sephardic community, but Sephardim had such things, only it wasn't an engagement, it wasn't shidduchim. They used to, until fairly recently at least, they made erisin long before the chuppah, and the erisin was in modern Hebrew, and my fiancé is Naruso. That's not what a Naruso is, but maybe it's a Sephardic influence for all I know. But it certainly was Kiddushin. It wasn't a simple erisin, but it was very similar to what was in America, this, quote, engagement, close quote. Now, let's then talk about Tnoim. Tnoim have lapsed, they pretty much, at least the old-fashioned kind of Tnoim that were entered into, and an instrument was drafted sometime before the wedding. What was the purpose of all of this? Well, there were two purposes, and I'm not sure which was the primary, which was the secondary. Number one, in days gone by, it was very common for the tutzdodim, parents of chosn, parents of the kala, to negotiate, in quotation marks, the negotiations were with regard to setting up the young couple in housekeeping. Remember, we're dealing with a marriage at a relatively early age. Somebody has to support the couple, usually not in an independent homestead, but in their own homes. And somebody has to set up the young man in some kind of business. Jews were traders. They were middlemen or what have you. This was capital intensive. Somebody had to provide the capital for all of this. And not to speak of the wedding expenses themselves, and all that was spelled out in detail. The articles of engagement were a contract with all the halachas of a contract. And people took it seriously because they took the conditions of engagement, the various tnoim, the specifics of this contract, very seriously. That was one reason for doing all of this. The second reason for this was the Gemara. Rav Mangid Amanda Kodesh Beloy Shiduche. Rav pronounces a klola on somebody who marries without shiduchim. Now what the word shiduche means in the Gemara, I will not pretend to give you a definitive definition. I think I have a fairly good idea of what it means. But there seem to be people out there who disagree with me. I understand shiduche means, quote, negotiations, close quote. It does not necessarily mean a written instrument. That Rav in effect says that don't find the young lady at some party and decide that you want to marry her on the spot. Before you do it, you have to have some type of, not courtship, but you have to have some type of planning for the event. Now, some people seem to think that Rav Mangid means you had to write a formal document. What was Rav trying to prevent? Well, when you become marrying Sams, the first thing you're going to learn in the city of New York is that when the couple comes with a license, read it carefully. The license says that it's not valid within the first 24 hours from the date that it was issued. And you'll find not only a piece of paper, but it will be stamped with a clock. And there will be an hour stamped on the clock. It's valid for, what, 60 days? I don't remember what it's valid for. I think it's 60 days. But it's not valid the first 24 hours. And why isn't it valid the first 24 hours? it's to prevent what I call the drunken sailor syndrome. You don't want somebody coming into port, going to the nearest bar and getting drunk, finding a young lady and marrying her and then jilting her the next morning or when the ship leaves. And how do you prevent all of that? By making him sober up. You give him 24 hours to think it over. Do they really want to get married or don't they want to get married? But that's clearly what Rav was concerned about, and that was the mangid beloy shiduchei. Now, the question is, what is the takona? It seems to me the takona was, you know, don't get married without talking about it first, and talking, take some planning, duchim your planning, which means that in our day and age, there has to be some type of planning and negotiation, even if it's nothing more than going out and signing a contract with a caterer, and deciding who's going to pay for the expenses of the caterer. I think that the only good reasons I can find for hiring a catering hall is to be Yetzer Rav Mangid. I can't see any other reason for the elaborate chasnas that we have. So that's the libetzchus I have for this modern institution. We'll talk about Balkashkis in some other forum. But that's a separate issue, and I'm not supposed to be talking about things like that. I leave that to others. But it seems to me that nobody is over Rav Mangid man the Kodesh below Shiduche unless you elope. He wants to prevent elopement. But in these circumstances, there's no real problem. There are other people who think that it's a formality and that he requires a kind of a takone that you have something in writing before you get married. Now, so fine, Tanoim served that purpose, obviously, so why discontinue it? It was discontinued. I don't know if people realize why they discontinued it. Maybe I am projecting, but I suspect that it has fallen into disuse because of the high incidence of broken engagements, not to speak about broken marriages. Broken marriages are bad enough. Broken engagements can be even worse than broken marriages. And that's because the Tanoim, and I think there's a form for the Tanoim in the back, must be among the that's probably not the usual form. I'll talk about that in a second. The Tanoim have the classic Tanoim have a clause that says Haknas Liifter Sacherim Vacherim Liifter Saknas, is a reference to a penalty. In common law, was called breach of promise, and until sometime in the mid 1930s, it was actionable in the state of New York. You walked away from the chuppah, you were subject to a lawsuit, and there were damages that could be collected. That's the knas. And the Bali HaTosfos and the Rambam all had problems with regard to how is the knas enforceable. It's a penalty clause. Penalty clauses are not generally enforceable. So the Bali HaTosfos had their explanation, and the Rambam didn't have an explanation. Rambam's explanation was to draft a totally different instrument that would render it something other than a knas. And if you want to read all about it, you can read the chapter on the sages of Spain in volume probably 4 of Contemporary Halakhic Problems. That's there in the context of an undertaking to execute the get. But the Chachmei Sfarad had their way of dealing with enforcing a knas, which was quite different from the way it was done in Ashkenaz, and what's in the standard kind of ksuba reflects the minig of the Ashkenazim, not minig, it's psak halacha of the Ashkenazim. But worse, it says that even paying the knas won't pater the cherem. And what is this cherem? I never knew what the cherem was until I came upon the Chassam Sofer dealing with, in essence, copyright. And the cherem that you find in the Shar Blot of just about every Sefer that was published in the 20th century in Europe, in which there's a Hazara, that it's Hazisar Hasog as Gevul Yedua is usually how it starts, and then it tells you about a cherem for anybody who will publish a pirated edition. Now, there was, again, it's not for this, some other forum. There was a Din Torah in the days of the Chassam Sofer. He and Rav Mordechai Benet disagreed very, very strongly with regard to how this is supposed to be enforced. It had to do with a pirated edition of the Reitelheim, Sidurim, and Malzerim, which are to this day used on the other side of the island in Frankfurt on the Hudson. The Reitelheim was a particular edition, and somebody wanted to go into competition. And the question was, could they do this in violation of the Cheirim? It's historically a fascinating little episode, because the one of the people who was involved was a certain Herr Schmidt, who wasn't Jewish at all. He was behind this enterprise, and they ended up in a German court. But in any event, Chassam Sofer writes that Shuva, basically, Barchai Benet had a very, very strong argument. He says, it's all very nice. A Rav in his community can issue a Cheirim. He's the Morad Asra, he's the Yav Bezdin. But what he does in his community is not binding on me in my community. Therefore, a Cheirim in Frankfurt is not binding in Dierenfurt. And the Chassam Sofer had to respond to that. I know, he published the pirate edition someplace else. And Chassam Sofer responded by saying, you're making a mistake. It's not the local Rav who issues the Cheirim. The Cheirim, he is only triggering what he calls the Cheirim HaKadmonim. There's an ancient Cheirim against doing these things. Comparable, says the Chassam Sofer, to the Cheirim HaShiduchim, the Cheirim that you find in the Tnoim. What Cheirim? Who pronounced this Cheirim? We don't know. It's in the dark recesses of Jewish history. And says the Chassam Sofer, it's a Cheirim HaKadmonim. And stash it in all of Klal Yisrael, and the Cheirim said that whenever the Rav signs a piece of paper, it triggers the old Cheirim. Well, with regard to the Cheirim HaShiduchim, I understand it. Could go back to Rav Mangi, for all I know, or maybe even before Rav. But I don't think that this kind of Cheirim with regard to copyright could go back earlier than Herr Gutenberg and his printing press, which was only about 400 years earlier than the Chassam Sofer, 300 years earlier than the Chassam Sofer. But that's not our problem today. In any event, we have this Cheirim. And the Gro maintained Lahaloche, that the Cheirim is, today people keep asking for Niskois, for Ashtar Mechila, breaking engagement, you want a piece of paper that in effect serves to rescind the conditions of the Tnoim and conveys license to the other party to enter into a new marital contract. The Gro maintained that this Cheirim is not subject to waiver, unless it's one of the cases where Kreifin Lagarish. If there's Kviya on Besdin to divorce, doesn't make very much sense to have promulgated the Cheirim in the first place to force these people to get married. Anything short of that, and a careful Blushoinis, Kreifin Lagarish, Chayiv Lagarish doesn't enter into this, whatever Chayiv Lagarish means. But the Gro maintains that you're in violation of the Cheirim and that the parties can't just walk away, even with mutual consent. The only eitz, according to the Gro, is to get married and then divorced. So the Bizbeach is married the Mois on a person who's Megarish Yishtei Rishoina. That's bad enough. It's not as bad as a Cheirim. So I suspect that the people who were instrumental in abrogating the Cheirim were concerned with the Gro. Otherwise, I don't know why they were or what bothered them. But I am being again dandem lakav schus. I presume they were all lomdim, and they realized the Gro, and they were concerned about it, and tzaddikim also. And therefore, since there's so many broken engagements, they didn't want to have to do all of this. And therefore, no more tnoim. Now, no more tnoim sounds terrible, because Rav Mangi demanded the Kodesh B'lo Shiduche, and they obviously disagree with me. They didn't need a piece of paper. So they want to have their halachic pie and eat it too. How do you have tnoim without having tnoim? So you write the tnoim at the smorgasbord. You write the tnoim right before the chuppah, because at that point you take it for granted that the people aren't going to walk away. I have often, they already paid the caterer, so how can they walk away from the chuppah? I have often said that the incidence of divorce in the Soviet Union is far, far higher than in any other country, because there are no caterers. All you do is sign a piece of paper, it's easy in, another piece of paper to get to end the marriage, easy in, easy out. But once you've invested, then it becomes serious. So once the investment has been made at the, you know, at the smorgasbord, they're not going to break the engagement anymore. So these people were no longer concerned, and therefore you have this new minig America, which was unheard of in Europe, and that is tanoim immediately before the chuppah. Does that solve the problem? I saw some hands up. I don't think it solves the problem at all. It simply replaces one problem with another problem. We'll talk about that in a second. Yes?
Why is it that if they break the engagement after having signed the tanoim, the violation of the cherem?
Because the tanoim invokes the cherem. It says so in the tanoim, if you ever saw one. Not too many people have seen them anymore. The real ones, not the kind that you have here. I'll talk about that in a second. It says that it's a brief, cryptic reference. There's a provision for a knas, and it says a knas liyifter sacher. Which cherem? Doesn't say anything about cherem. Liyifter es sacher. Says the chasam sefer this cherem hakadmonim.
The knas
is the fine. Broken engagement, pay. But don't think you can just buy your way out. Because even if you pay, you're still going to be subject to the cherem.
But that's not necessarily Rav Man Gerem.
No. I said that some sefer says we don't know where. So I said they've been Rav too, for all I know. That he was mangid on somebody who doesn't write the Shidman Mangimad Kodesh B'lo Shiguche. And maybe that was part of the original Takana. That's my little Kiddush. Now, part of the original Takana was that if you break the Tanoim, you'll also be in the Cherem. I'll be mangid on you too. I have no evidence for that. Some sefer doesn't say that. It was not stated any place. So we don't know. All he knew is that he doesn't know. Namely, he doesn't know who promulgated this cherem. Nor does he know about the cherem for pirating a publication. And he says these are called this a cherem akadmeini. It's been around for generations. Sorry.
Same question.
Okay. Now the question is: does it solve anything? Rav Moshe never discusses this in detail, but for Rav Moshe, it doesn't solve anything at all. Rav Moshe maintains that it's the same cherem even if there's no written instrument. In some places they have what they call a kinyan without the written instrument. I think that's pretty obvious. Whatever effect a written document has, the kinyan has as well. Reducing it to writing is only a matter of evidence. But Rav Moshe goes beyond that, and what is in Yiddish called today avort, he thinks that that is tantamount to engagement and that it triggers the whole business. But putting that aside, that's one little problem. Have you solved any problem by not writing the tanoim? Rav Moshe doesn't really think you've solved anything. I have other problems. My other problem is I began all this by saying, and now this all of this, is it a mere technicality or is it there for a reason? There's another takana that comes together with this, and that is that tavua li nosei tzricha lispar zayniki. If a woman receives a proposal, she now has to count shiva nikim, even if, to the best of her knowledge, the monthly period has not occurred, nor has there been any intramenstrual spotting. Chazal were cheshish for what they call dam chimud. Dam chimud is entirely emotional. And therefore Chazal said that you have to wait shiva nikim. Now, it's a little difficult to have shiva nikim between the chosen's tish and the yichud unless you have either an extremely elaborate smorgasbord or you make a very long Shabbos HaGadol drush. So you know, they're not going to be Shiva Nakim after this. Now, the issue here is, and what is Tavua L'Nosei? Is Tavua L'Nosei, is this every Tavua L'Nosei? Or is it a tavua l'nosei which is likely to create emotional reactions or what have you? I can tell you of one Rosh Hashiva in the last generation who, when he was Masada Kedushin, and this was now his newfangled American Minhogin, they want the tanoim before the chuppah. He couldn't have cared less about the tanoim before the chuppah, but they want it. It's a photo op, incidentally, yes, and he got new kibbutzim. He can be mechabit somebody to read the ksuvah, and two other people to sign the ksuvah, that he insisted on being an aide on, I'm sorry, the tanoim. He insisted on being an aide on the tanoim, and he puzzled the tanoim. He managed to make sure that they would be puzzled. Now, he clearly thought that Tevuah Linosei was Gzeira. And yes, yeah, sometimes it's cogent, and other times it's Leifluk. And if there's a Leifluk, it depends on whether it's valid or not. If it's not valid, then there's no Fluk. If, on the other hand, it's emotional, then it's all in the mind of the Kala. And if she doesn't know it's possible, then what difference does it make? You can, and I don't know if it's reproduced or not, the Tshuva, the Chamudi Daniel, cited by the Piskei Tshuva in Ilvus Nida, that Tovua Lenosei creates Dam Chimud in and of itself, and therefore he's got a different Kachatimsa, not the one we're talking about, but wherever there is a new Tviyo Lenosei, you have to be Cheshish for Dam Chimud. Now, let me just explain the position of the people who think that it's empirical, biological, and you have to worry about it. I told you a moment ago that this is, the menses are controlled by emotions to a very significant extent. They're created, they're produced by the endocrine system. The endocrine system is subject to emotional changes, and it's this the Chazal we're concerned about. Again, if you become involved in these things, you will discover very, very rapidly that even young ladies who are fairly regular in their menses before they become engaged, everything goes off as soon as they are engaged. The result of that phenomenon is that despite the best laid plans of mice and women, they've carefully plotted the charts, so they figured out the days there aren't going to be problems. My very unscientific estimate is that at least 50% of all chuppas are chuppas nidah, and wasn't planned that way. And that's because they're now become irregular. Why have they become irregular? Because they are suffering from a malady that you will not find in the medical literature, but I have given it a name. I call it kalaitis. It's a stressful period for these people, for whatever reason. You and I were never callous, and we're never going to be callous. It's stressful enough for a chosen, but I have to believe that it's even more stressful for the kala, and the hormones, they react, and all kinds of things happen. That's what Chazal were concerned about. Tavua linosei shemesi dam chimud, and dam chimud you won't necessarily realize that she is experiencing. If that's what Chazal were worried about, then it's very empirical. It depends upon whether the Kala knows about all of this. The text that you have is what's called Rav Moshe's Tanoim. Now, I never discussed this with Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe never published it, but I know exactly what Rav Moshe was doing here. If number one, it leaves out this business with the providing for monetary compensation and the conditions. It says simply that the Tutzdodim have fulfilled all that they have undertaken to fulfill. And that's in the text, whether it's true or not. So it's a dangerous business if they haven't. And then he says in the text, the only thing that remains is for them to walk down the aisle, and that they're going to do presently, and this you sign, and break the plate, so that you take a picture. That's the time. What does this solve? It solves the Rav Mangid if you think that it is a formalistic kind of katkone. And note what's missing. If you compare this with a classic traditional tnoim, the tnoim are about the only instrument that I'm aware of in which the parties sign. A shtar is signed by Edin, not by the parties. For whatever reason, if you look at the text of Tnoim, the ones that you find in Mefer Yisvarim or in the Nachla Shiva, you have the text to Edim, and Uliyeser says, the Chosn and the Kala will sign it also. And then come the signatures of the Chosn and the Kala. That is absent in Rav Moshe's text. Why is it absent in Rav Moshe's text? Because I am absolutely certain he didn't want the Kala to know about this. He wants this to be done other than in the absence of the Kala. He wants it done where it is done generally, what they call the Chosin's dish, and the Kala doesn't have to be aware of it. Because Rav Moshe, I presume, was Cheshish for the Chamudi Daniel, and the Chamudi Daniel makes sense only if somebody asks the Kala, you're really ready to go through with all of this. particularly if the challah is a talmida chachama, use that term rather than some other terms that are floating around out there. She knows everything that I just told you, and she knows the chazal were cheshish for dam chimud. She also knows that this is serious business, and that it's not serious until you sign the tnaim. And if she knows that, then there's every reason, says Chamudi Daniel, why there should be a problem. And therefore, if you want to have your little chumrah without having the chumrah dosa zekula, the only way to do it is with Ramesh's nusach that doesn't involve the kala at all. Yes?
According to this reasoning, would we not be worried about dam chimud under the chuppah?
No. Chazal weren't worried about dam chimud under the chuppah. Under the chuppah, they're too busy shokling and saying tilin, whatever else. That, but that point becomes a different kind of seriousness. It becomes awesome when you know when you're still in the excitement stage. That causes down chim, but it goes under the chuppah, and just look at their faces. You can tell the difference. You know, once they get under the chuppah, they look like ghosts more often than not. It's a different kind of reaction. At least I presume that's what the Chabudi Daniel means. Because otherwise, every kala should be there should be a tovul lenosei hari abu gadeshusli. That they didn't think was a tovul lenosei. Okay, so enough with the engagement. Let's now talk. Oh yes, one other point I just want to make in passing. I know it's fashionable today to use the pill in order to regulate the period, so that there won't be problems, and that will take care of. Irregular menses also, for whatever reason. I caution you, if you want to use it, talk to a doctor and talk about it seriously. There are two problems. And I'm, Bossy Rock lawyer. The first is that standard medical advice is not to become pregnant for 3 months after going off the pill. How long you have to be on the pill to worry about the 3 months afterwards, they're worried about congenital defects for 3 months afterwards. That's a significant medical problem. How serious is it? I'm not a doctor. I don't pretend to know. I'm not going to talk about the dangers associated with use of hormones in general. They're not to be dismissed, although I suspect that when you have somebody who's been on the hormones for 20 years or so, it becomes a more serious problem than if it's only been for a couple of months. But again, that's something to be discussed with somebody who is at least presumed to have read all the scientific literature. And then kulahai v'ulai, you may get an informed opinion, but it's not something to be done lightly. Enough said, let me go on to other things. Okay. Yes?
Based on the Chamuli Daniel, can we justify the minhag that many people have of not having the chazan kala not taught?
That had nothing to do with Chamuli Daniel, nor do I have
I don't know.
Of the chosen kal not talking for 7 days. Well, if it will be chamud daniel, it should be from when she starts counting the zayin nekiim, which is not necessarily 7 days before the chuppah. I can. There are lots of minhagei Yisrael that have nothing to do with halacha, and they're pretty good practices. If I don't know of any source for it, and I can tell you that. There are pictures of Gedolei Yisrael taken before the chuppah with their kala. So apparently they saw each other before the chuppah. I suspect the reason was very simple and very practical. Everybody's on edge. The kala's on edge. Hosan's on edge, maybe less than the kala. The last thing that you want is a lover's quarrel within the week before the wedding. This is one way to avoid it, and a lot of little things going on has satisfying both families, and forget about the chosen kala themselves and everything. It's a lot safer if they don't see each other. I'm talking on the phone just with that. I remember when they weren't seeing each other, they weren't talking on the phone either. But phone calls, you know, if they're lengthy, usually are shorter than actual face-to-face visits. I think that the minhag in quotation marks arose simply because they realized that it's healthier for all concerned if the chosen kala don't see each other. My impression is that this minhag was virtually unknown in Lita. But again, I wasn't there. Just what I get second and third hand. Okay? Now, more problems. Let me begin with what is the people who will be consulting you. Your most serious shilas will be, what day do I have to say Kaddish? Which day is my yahrzeit? Particularly as an other sheni. And the most stressful thing that people come to rabbis with is that the kala's mother, the kala has the same name that I have, and that's terrible. Occasionally it's the chosn, the chamaisai, the chosnai, the father-in-law and the chosn. More often it's the kala and the mother. Now, maybe that's because women are more concerned about these things than men, but I think there's a better reason than that. Not either of them is terribly good. Now, this is, you know, to some people, this is a tremendously significant problem. Now, why is it a problem in the first place? Where is the source for all of this? The source for all of this is a tzavah, Reb HaChosid, who says that a person shouldn't marry a woman whose mother has the same name as, should marry a woman who has the same name as his mother. And then there are other sources with regard to the chosn and the father-in-law. Now, what was the basis for all of this? Well, there are two bases. One is Kabbalah, and that's a cop-out. Kabbalah, he's trying to kisvi hari. The reason for Kabbalah, hanistoros lo shem elokeinu, who knows? Not mechuyif, no, don't really be concerned about it. Now, the Neidei Behuda assumes that all of this is Kabbalistic in nature. And where's the page? What page is it on? Page 88, if I might have it right. The 81. If you look at page 81, and I want to make sure that you read parts of the tshuva, and I want you to know the contents of the tshuva, not because I'm concerned about the name of the kala and the mother-in-law, but because of some of the other things he says in the tshuva. It's a short tshuva, you can go through it very, very quickly. He says, Da Talmidi v'chadig. What happens is that one of his Talmidim tells a story about a brother-in-law or somebody who wanted to marry a young lady whose name was the same as his mother. He says, Yudvarim halolu chakuk imaluach libecholu zikorin haklal hagodol. It goes beyond the Shaila. Shein l'chol chachomim shachra Talmud reshus loimar dover neged haTalmud. V'aymer dover lister kutze yud midivri Talmud lo yichoshe bichlal chachme Yisrael. I hope I don't have to translate. Now, he says, and look, tzavos yivud achosid, it's connected to Gemara. He talks about marrying shtei achoyos, he talks about all kinds of things that we know that the Amoroyim did. What's all of this about? So if you find it someplace like yivud achosid, chayov yivonu limshkuni nafshin letaris dvorov, sholoi diber rak lishor limshpocha protis, v'divri Talmud heim ala klal, that he's talking about some kind of exceptional circumstances and it's not a general rule. Because otherwise, the things that you find in Savos from Yud HaChosid, Devorim shekimat osser lo nelushaymon. And he then proceeds to tell us that Rav Yud HaChosid issued the Tzavur for his own progeny because he knew that with Ruach HaKodesh, Zivugom lo yetzliach, if they enter into one of the zivugim, they told them not to. If he cautioned against these things, it's because he knew that if they did, there would be among his progeny people who would not have very successful marriages. But it was not intended for the rest of Klal Yisrael. The rest of Klal Yisrael can ignore it. And then in the very end, he adds something else. He says he doesn't understand. He says that he realizes that he writes a chesrol is chatin im tzurvim rabbonon v'shem mitzvusu the chosn is a ben teire u'tamahani al reif o'ilom shalak sith litais bitom lam oretz hu poshut etzlom ben chesish limona hu negedivri chazal shomru kilu kreifsom en nichol ifnei ari the name is the least of the things to worry about in the Shidduch. There are a lot of other things to worry about and those should be of much more concern than the name, even if you think the name is something to be concerned about. That's the Lady Yehuda, yes.
I mean, according to the Lady Yehuda, it's cloud here, so then wouldn't the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom also be, you know, connected to Talmud, because we have cases of, you know, polygamy throughout the Gemara?
Polygamy is a little bit different. He was making it as a cherem. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid isn't making it as a cherem. He's not saying making a cherem. He says cherem's got to have a reason to. And he's not telling you why he's doing all of this. The cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom had a reason. Precisely what the reason is, I'm not going to talk about now. And it's problematic because at the time he issued the cherem, there was no polygamy among Western Jewry. It was virtually zero polygamy. I think that he did it simply to reinforce his cherem against divorcing a wife against her will, because otherwise, marry your secretary and keep your wife as a scullery maid. And the only way you can prevent that is by having a cherem against polygamy also. But, and that was, you know, for good reason. Wherever there was a reason for a cherem, you can issue a cherem. It's not connected to Gemara to say it needs a siyog of one kind or another. But the Rabbi Yehuda is usually saying there's something intrinsically bad about this. Now, if it's because it's Begay and the Ilomis Helyenim, or it does all kinds of weird things to the spheres, then why didn't it do it in the days of Chazal too? What's the difference? If you tell me it's only this little group, that's your little group, but if it's for everybody, what's changed from once upon a time to now? The physical universe is Nishtana HaTeva. The metaphysical universe isn't Nishtana. It's the same universe. Okay, now, if you look in the Truva of the Chassam Sefer, which is probably also here, you'll find, with regard to the Chosn and the father-in-law, there are a lot of sources to say that it's only Mishuloshim, if it goes for three generations, not for two. And again, I said earlier, you'll find women are more concerned about this. It may not be just because they're women, as a thing for men, but Kal v'chamayso, you find in the Kisvei Ho'ari, in addition to Tzavah Rabbi Dachosid, the husband and the father-in-law is not in the Kisvei Ho'ari, or at least so they tell me. I'm certainly not a book in the Kisvei Ho'ari. But they tell me it's not there, so that apparently it made less of an impact because it only a Tzavah Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. Now, there is also in Achronim a perfectly rational explanation for all of this that has nothing to do with Kabbalah, not mystical at all. And they maintain that this was either simply kibud of aim, because if you have a father and a husband with the same name, you're going to be calling your husband by his name and it's the name of your father. In the presence of the father, there may be problems with kibud of. The ramifications of that we'll worry about some other time, but therefore people didn't want such shidduchim. The second reason they gave is that before the invention of the incandescent bulb, if you have a situation of this sort, you can have a catastrophe on your hands. Somebody calls in the middle of the night and there's a response, but the response isn't from the person who was called. It's the mother-in-law instead of the wife. And they weren't willing to be samech on the tzias ayin the kolo. The voices are different. They were afraid of what might happen. That's what you find in Acharonim. Now, what's the solution to all of this? If you're concerned in the first place? Now, at this point, you probably have heard between the lines. I don't take the whole business so seriously to start with. But if you take it seriously and the people out there want to avoid the problem one way or another, so there are ways around it. Ways around it both in terms of the facts on the ground and creating facts on the ground. Number one, for these purposes, if the individual has two names and the other person has only one name or the second name is different, those do not count as the same name, whether or not the person is actually called by both names. We're not going to spend too much time on all of this, but there is what in halacha is called the Shem Ha'arisa, literally the cradle name. It's the given name, which you received at birth, at the bris, or at the kiddush and shul in the case of a girl. That's the Shem Kiddush, and it has all kinds of, you know, meanings in halacha. Not to speak of Kabbalah. If the Shem Arisa is different, then most Achronim maintain there's no problem at all, and that's because they think that this is a matter of Kabbalah. if it were a matter of practicality, they wouldn't be concerned with the Shem Arisa, but the name, but the name that is actually used. Now remember, people get two names, and you'll hear the two names only when the Shamus calls them to an aliyah. The rest of the time, they use one name. And their wives, their husbands use one name. If you're worried about practicalities, that's the name for all intents and purposes. If you're talking about other things, then the Shem Arisa is the name that you got at the Bris or at the Kiddush, and that has all kinds of meanings in Halach, in Kabbalah. Now, again, let me make one little point, and it's the parallel to this, or the flip side of the coin, but don't worry about the flip side of the coin, because, or I'll tell you why not to worry about it in a second. People give names for all kinds of reasons, and families fight about whether the father's side's going to get the name, the mother's side's going to get the name, and then the machatonim fight with each other about which side of the grandparents is going to get the name. All of this is because somehow this is a schus of one kind or another for the nifter. So what do people do? They keep everybody happy. They give one person one name, the other person another name, you give a double name. And the process, they have managed to rob the name of any Kabbalistic meaning that it might have. Because the Shem Avrohom and the Shem Yitzchok are two separate names. And they are both different from the Shem Avrohom Yitzchok. Avrohom Yitzchok is not Avrohom plus Yitzchok. It's a new name. It's called Avrohom Yitzchok. And if nobody had that name, one's Avrohom, the other's Yitzchok, you didn't name them after two people. You named them after nobody. But please don't tell anybody that secret, because ignorance is bliss. If everybody is happy, that may be more important than whatever all these Kabbalah and Yoni might possibly be. So, but all of these said, quite logically within this matrix, that if the chos of the Kala or the mother-in-law had two names and the other had only one name, it's not the same name. If it's not the same name, don't worry about it. They're absolutely right. If you worry about Kabbalah, it's not the same name. Yes? It's his name, two names, for the next cycle.
Right, but that's a
Chaloshem name. That's a Chaloshem, yeah. If it's a Chaloshem, it's a Chaloshem. Yes, absolutely. Then there are others who maintained that if there is any other name besides the Shem Arisa, including a Shem Laz, and they're not totally identical in the Shemless Laz and all the other names, there's nothing to worry about. That in America was the easiest way to get out of it. It was always the European in the family was concerned. But the Sora has a daughter-in-law whose name is Susan, and she barely remembers the Shem Arisa of the Sora. For these people, that didn't count because she has a Shem Laz. It's called Susan. There's another, I don't really remember where I saw it, but I saw it in the Tshuva. And it's you know, if I wouldn't have read it, I would have had trouble believing it. But it's a story of a shivach between blue bloods, Hasidic blue bloods. Two Rebbeshe families are being shadach, and the Chos and Kala didn't meet each other until the Tnoim, and nor did the Machatonim really see each other. They had corresponded or had a shadchan as a go-between, but now they've planned the simcha, and they're all sitting at the table ready to write Noim, and somebody curses somebody to ask what's the name of the Kala. Till then nobody knew what the name of the Kala was, and it turns out that the Kala's name is the same as the future mother-in-law, and the Chosin's father is very upset by all of this because it's going to be Kala Kamaisa. So the Kala's father, who was more sagacious, I think, asks his mechutin, and what does everybody call your wife? Mm-hmm. So he looks at him and says, in Yiddish, Rebbetzin Rufnir! Mazel Tov, her name is Rebbetzin. If everybody calls her Rebbetzin, she's got a new name, and therefore there's an additional name, you don't have to worry about it. So that's, you know, taking this other name to the kind of an extreme. The title also counts as a name. The Nagev Yehuda himself talks about a Shinui Hashem, and their Shinui Hashem was different from the Shinui Hashem that we practice, the extent that it's practiced at all, our Shinui Hashem involves adding a name. They actually change, Reuven to Shimon or whatever. And now the problem is with regard to Shiduchim, which is the real name. So Yehuda says that the old name you changed, don't worry about the old name. And the new name, even if the new name is the same, it's Lebrocha V'loy L'Klola. You don't give names for brochas, you don't give names to make problems, and therefore there's no problem with the new name at all. Okay, that's the Nevi Yehuda. Now, what I'm really concerned about, and I would have skipped over all of this, except that there's some people who think they have the ultimate solution. And their ultimate solution is that they are going to give the, particularly Chosin of Meisai, they're going to tell the Chosin to change his name, particularly if he had two names and was using Avram Yitzchok, and everybody calls him Avram, but from now on call yourself Yitzchok. Therefore they think that they're going to change the problem. Certainly if they change the name totally and completely, they think they have solved the problem. There's a Chuvin Reb Meisai which is in the package. Rav Moshe advises strongly against it. And I want to emphasize and reiterate the reasons for being against this. Now, the names are small change, but this happens all the time, and people often ask Rabbonim to become complicit in this in one way or another. The standard situation, and people, very well-meaning people, once upon a time was Talmud Torah, now I hear it goes on in day schools to some extent. You have people who come from families that were not exactly muchzak b'chassidus, and they show up in the Talmud Torah and the teacher asks for Hebrew names. After all, this is a Jewish school. In a Jewish school you have to have a Hebrew name. And there's some people out there, including teachers who should know better, who think that you absolutely must have a Hebrew name, otherwise there's something missing in your Jewishness or in your Hebrewness or your Israeliness or whatever. I don't know what the motive is. But if you don't have one, we'll give you one. So to go back to my example before, if your name is Susan and you never had a Hebrew name or you don't remember what the Hebrew name was, so Susan must be Sora, and from now on, when she calls the roll, she's going to call Sora. And the kid is going to answer. Now, that may or may not be very nice, but the problem is that, unfortunately, her friends still call her Susan. When she goes home, her mother calls her Susan. And the first problem is, even if the teachers still call her Sora, and she knows she's still Sora, and once a year at the alumni reunion, the principal calls her Sora, and now Cholila, if she has to have a get, we won't even talk about the Ksuva, do you write Sora, do you write Susan the Miskari Sora, or Sora the Miskari Susan, and you're giving the Masader Haget just another headache. And worse will happen is that when you're going to be Masader the get or the Ksuba, she'll ask the Hebrew name, and she'll say, don't have a Hebrew name. Oh yes, I have a Hebrew name. My teacher in the third grade told me my name was Sora. And here you've got to know a little bit. The next question should be, and has anybody ever used the name Sora since the third grade? Does anybody know the name Sora? And she says no, you should promptly forget about it. If she gives some other answer, you may have to do something else. But the basic point is that you've bought yourself a package of troubles. That the problem is going to be, was the name Muchzak? And if it was Muchzak, is it later Nishtakach? Just because the teacher puts it down in her little roll book doesn't necessarily mean that it becomes a name. And if it is a name, it's not a Shem Arisa, and it's easily Nishtakach. And what are you going to do, Chalil, in a get? And your problem, what are you going to do in a Ksuba? Let me make one, I'll come back to this problem a little bit later. I'll give you one rule. When in doubt, don't write the Hebrew name. One of these names that have been given to somebody. You leave it out, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's why in day schools they should not be giving names, Hebrew names, to people who don't have them. It only creates problems, and when you've got the tzuba to deal with, you've got to handle those problems. If you're only worried about the Shem Kala, the Shem Chamaisa, that pales into significance when you're dealing with a problem of what may well be a ksuba that's possible. Now, what are people doing all of this? I suppose it's because they are very from. Shaloshinu Shimon, everybody has to have a Hebrew name. You've got kind of a constitutional right to a Hebrew name or what have you. Ignoring the fact that one of the Bali HaTesus is a certain Rabbeinu Peter, who didn't bother looking for a Hebrew name. Now, Peter is Peter. I never heard of a more non-Jewish name than Peter. If he wasn't worried about it, why do we have to worry about it? Shinu Shmo means Shinu, not if you never had it in the first place. You never had. I'll tell you one story. I am not usually Masadagitan, but in the bad old days, before the collapse of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, there were people in the Soviet Union who needed Gitan, and there was a kind of an underground. People were being sent to give shiur and to refuse snakes and to be Masadagitan at the same time. And I was saddled with such a get, and dealing not with the Chos and the Kala, that wasn't the problem. They didn't have even names. But the Adim, one of the Adim was very nice. He had a Hebrew name, and I saw him in shul in the morning. He got Elias. He had a Hebrew name, and he's about to sign. So I asked, his name was Yankiv. And I said, what was your father's name? He said, the father's name is Avraham. Very good. And I give him a piece of paper to make him practice writing Yaakov ben Avraham, write 8 afterwards. Good. Then comes the second one, and his name is Moshe. What's your father's name? Ben Avraham. And I noticed they're looking at each other. I didn't like what I saw. I didn't know what I saw, but I know I didn't like it. So I began asking them, who told you your name was Avraham? Is that the name you were given at your bris? You had a bris when you were 8 days old, v'chule. And they blanch a little bit, and he tells me, no, my father never had a bris. My father didn't give me a bris. And where did your father get the name Avraham? My father's name is not Avraham. What's your father's name? Your father's name is Vladimir. Where did you get the name Avraham? The Zakenim Bebet Takneset. You know, the old man in shul. You got to have a Hebrew name. And you have to have a patronym. Your father also has a Hebrew name. So if you don't have a Hebrew name, what do we do with a ger? We call him Ben Avraham. So you must be Ben Avraham also. And here comes up a Mavucha Gedela. Can you be Machzik Hashem for your father? For yourself, you can be Machzik all kinds of Shemus. Which to write first, which to write second, which to leave out in the get. Separate problem. But you can decide to call yourself Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse. You don't need a legal name change, even Bini Museihem, as long as you're not going to commit fraud and you don't want legal documents to be changed in any way. But if you decide that you want to be known as Mickey Mouse, nobody will stop you. It's perfectly legal, I assure you. And the halacha, you certainly can change your name. But can you change your father's name? Well, we have 3 shittas in Achronim. Some maintain you never can. Others maintain only if he's alive. And others maintain only if he's dead. Now, who wants to go be Makriya di Shailas? That's what happens when people assume names that are designed because they don't want the embarrassment or whatever they think it is of not having a Shem Kodesh. So what I was in the process of saying that's why to avoid Kalav Chamisa, for example. Don't go around changing names to avoid all of this. You'll end up not only with problems for the get, but even if you change it, and even if it sticks, the get may be kosher and the ksuba can be fossil, because it has to be muhsak as a proper shem before you write the ksuba. And if this is only a couple of days before the ksuba, it's unlikely that you can be machzik. It generally takes 30 days to be machzik a shem. And we don't now have to worry about being masik shem when you have sveikis for Siddur Gitin. You have to be masik shemus when there's sveikis. If there's no sofik, don't even try to be masik the shem. There's no reason for doing so. So, yes?
Did Rebbe get a different aid?
No, I made him write Ben Vladimir. Now my problem was, how do you spell Vladimir? Okay, that's a separate problem. But, okay, next. And the other one also wasn't Ben Avraham. It was another Russian name, of course. Please, this is the battle thing. Now, let me talk about the ksuba a little bit, and one major problem with regard to the ksuba. Number one, in writing the ksuba, the first thing, that, you know, going the order of the ksuba, the first problem will arise with regard to the name of the city. You've got to put the name of the city in the ksuba. Now, how do you spell the name of the city? The general rule is that you spell it the way it's muchzak for ksiva shtoris, the way it's muchzak among Jews, which means that if you're in a settled Jewish community which has had gittin and ksubas for decades, if not longer, it's got a name and you spell it exactly the way it's been spelled, even though I'll point out to you, I don't know who was machzik the shamus in these very cities, but there are major American cities in which the name was incorrectly established. But that's it. You spell it, pardon me, the way it's been accepted. Now, that goes way beyond simply the spelling. It goes even to the actual name of the city. Will somebody please tell me how to be Masader a Ksuba in Alexandria in Egypt? Like, how do I spell Alexandria? Not Kushta, that's Istanbul. Kushta, not Kushta. In Alexandria, you spell Nun Vov or Nun Vov Aleph, Aleph Mem Vov Nun. Does that sound like Alexandria to you? Go to the library, take any sefer that was published in Egypt, and you'll see that it was published in Nu Amon. That's what Jews called the city. It was Muxa. You won't know what you're talking about. It was Muxaka's Nu Amon, and it didn't change. To this day, in Amsterdam, I don't have the text that I get from Amsterdam, but Amsterdam, is, they have two names in the get. Amsterdam and Amsterdam, because the Jews in the city refer to the place as Amsterdam. Now, there are other cities in which you have similar problems, and there's an exception to the rule also. In Leningrad, where I also have the dubious honor of having to worry about a get. What's the name of the city in Perksivus Gitan?
St. Petersburg?
Not St. Petersburg, heaven forfend. Petersburg! The saint was dropped. Jews never talked about St. Petersburg. Petersburg is English. And didn't call it Sata Petersburg. They called it Petersburg. And that's how they spelled it. Only you didn't write Petersburg. But now you write Petersburg. He didn't write in those days Petersburg because it was Malchus Makpedes. They were Makped on the whole kitten. You could go to jail if they caught you doing what you were doing. But to use that, if they caught you writing Petersburg, then you're a real reactionary. You want to bring back the Tsar, obviously. And that means that he was Siberia for life instead of for 10 years. I don't know why. But it was Malchus Makpedes, and they wrote Leningrad. You have to understand what this means. Americans don't understand it. I don't understand it either. I was once a participant in a conference, a Jewish conference, in a city called Istanbul in Turkey, and the chairman went over to every speaker who had a beard, every rabbinic speaker, whispered into his ear, "I understand that rabbinic scholars refer to the city as Constantinople." And he asks as a favor to please not use the word Constantinople. And I don't know what the penalty would be for calling it Constantinople, but you know that Greece and Turkey went to war against each other, and that Constantinople was not Constantinople, but Kushta, but they changed the name from Constantinople to Istanbul. And what happens to the Gitan? The Gitan don't say Kushta anymore. What they do say, I don't want to talk about today, that's a separate issue. They write the name of the Shchuna, which is improper, but whatever, that doesn't puzzle. But they do whatever they're doing in Istanbul. But the Malchus was Makfid, so he didn't use the old name. But you use the old name even if there has been a change. The fact that there is a change in terms of what people call the city, it makes absolutely no difference as long as there's a kind of a Masorah, a Kabbalah, the Jews continue calling it by the old name. For example, there is no city in the United States called Bronx. It's a borough, and we don't write names of boroughs. Yeah, they still write Bronx, and that's because before 1899, the Bronx was a separate city, became incorporated afterwards. There is no city called Brooklyn, and they still write Brooklyn, because till 1899 it was Brooklyn. Not only that, but places like Kew Gardens, I understand, or Rockaway, are still, the names are still used, because those were independent municipalities, and it was Mufsak as such among Jews, so they continue using whatever they had before. Now, how will you know whether it's Mufsak or not? And the short answer is, well, there's some compendia. I'll give them to you more or less in chronological order. There is what I consider to be a modern classic. It's called Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever. Was written probably in the 60s. Somebody went to the various offices in which Gittin had been kept, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, and they had Gittin from all over the world, and he reports what he saw. And I gave you a page from Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever. We'll talk about that in a moment. That's the first place you can look to see whether the place is Mufsak. You won't find terribly many American cities in Mufsak there. Then there's another sefer, it's called Matzeves Pinchas. Rabbi Bach, I believe his name was, wrote it. He was a rov in Baltimore. And it's got a couple of pages with the names of cities in America. Then came a little pamphlet called Ha'oretz Le'oreho, and you have that in the list of compendia. Ha'oretz Le'oreho will give you just about every American city that was Mufsak in one way or another, but it's not exhaustive. It doesn't claim to be exhaustive. It couldn't be exhaustive. But if there is anything that's been going on for a significant period of time with the numbers, you'll probably find it there, including all the shilas. You'll find it there in the footnotes. Sorry. There was a hand up? Okay. There are places in which the name or the spelling of the city has been Mufsak more or less incorrectly. For example, we'll talk about the clothing in a minute. But Buffalo, people are spelling with two p's. You don't spell Buffalo with two p's. Double consonants are ignored for purposes of transliteration. Queens, how do you spell Queens? Well, I'm not going to talk about it, but I don't think they were Moxic the way it's pronounced. But we'll worry about that at some other time. Now, if you look, what page is it? Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever. There's a city I hear. It's got a kind of small Jewish population. It's called New York. How do you spell New York in a ksuba? What page is Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever? Page 150. On page 150. You've got just two little pages from Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever. First of all, you have No Amon, which simply comes before New York, and you see New York spelled Nun Vav Aleph Yud Aleph Resh Kuf, with a space between New and York. That is the accepted transliteration of New York. I can add, you write the both words on a single line, not on two lines, not New on one line, York on the next line. Not likely to happen in the soup, and the get it could easily happen. And the space between them is kamoli is kitano, not a full space, but a half space. It's less than between two letters, but not as much as between two different words. Now, you will see that he makes reference to a number of tshuvas as well as a number of gitin, and he tells you that there's some gitin written in New York that had the name of the city spelled Nev York, Nun Ayin Vov Yod Yud Aleph Resh Kuf. Have you ever heard anybody speak about this city as Nev York? I have. I'm a little bit older than you. I'll tell you who it was. It was the cook in the yeshiva who came from Galicia right after the war. And the yeshiva was in New York, but the boys were always going to New York. Gaten New York, Construction New York, in New York, New York. That's how they pronounced it. In the next column, you'll find that there are some people who were pronouncing it in New York. And the big issue was, how are you kiveya the spelling? Now, there's one principle. I gave you the entire kuntres of Rav Henkin with regard to transliteration. There's one basic point that Rav Henkin makes, and Rav Levin Zichron Levracha, the Beis Ovi, makes it the flip side of the coin. Rav Henkin says that the first settlers here came from Russia and Lithuania, and they were kiveya, the way things are being pronounced. What Rav Levis, who was a Polish rov, said was that unfortunately we got here last, and the other people came first, and they were kiveya. So we're stuck with the way, whatever they did, what they were kiveya, they were kiveya. Now, the Gittin almost invariably that were executed in New York were spelled either Nun Vov Yud Aleph Reish Kuf, some of them is one word, or they were spelled Nun Vov Aleph. Why Nun Vov Aleph and Nun Vov, I don't know, that's a separate problem, usually with a space in between Yud Aleph Reish Kuf. Now, but they wrote differently because they were sending it to Galicia, and you write in accordance with the pronunciation of Mokim Shenishlach Lashon. But here it was New York, there it was New York, or in Hungary, New York, or whatever they were calling it. Now, remember one thing, that it's all wrong. Everything I'm saying is wrong. That's not how you're supposed to spell New York. How do you pronounce New York? All of these are absolutely wrong. How is your English? What is the name of the street on the Lower East Side that begins with an H?
Houston.
No, it's Houston Street. It's Houston, Texas. There's a problem. These New Yorkers don't know how to speak English. They pronounce it Houston Street. People out there, or at least the intelligentsia, don't refer to New York. The city is called New York. The EW sound phonetically is a usual U, or U sound. Jews never pronounced it. When they spoke Yiddish, that's the language they spoke. They didn't pronounce it New York, Nun Yudvav. You'll see modern stuff spells it Nun Yudvav. That's in conformity with what is the Queen's English, except we don't have a Queen. But that's how somebody who's a purist or a pedant will pronounce New York. Others say New York, and that's it. And Jews said New York, that's why they spelled it New York. How do you write New York? If you were to ask me, I would have said Nun Vov. We'll come to that later. One thing I do know is that Reuven Grzelskis, he was Rosh Yeshiva in Spring Valley, came back once from a Gudas Rabboni convention, not convention, it was a meeting. He was extremely upset. And one of the items on the agenda was uniformity in spelling New York in Gittin, from the Sefer Gittin. And they decided it by a show of hands. And he didn't particularly have a position, to the best of my knowledge, or if he did, he didn't say anything about it. But he said, whoever heard of having a meeting and just raising hands to decide to spell it one way or another way, it should have been a matter of deliberation. They should have gotten people to write tshuvas to explain. Then the people know something about it. They're the ones who should make the decision. But what is this? A popularity contest? You're going to decide by a simple vote without having investigated the problem altogether. In any event, from then on it became a kviyas. There's no question. After the fact, it's Nun Vov Aleph. What the Aleph there is doing is a separate issue entirely, but that's the spelling of New York, and you have it here in front of you for all ksubas. Now, let me make one point before I go on. 2 points. There are certain forms out there, in fact, most forms out there, have the space for the name of the city, and then it says, Asher b'America Hatzafenis. Asher b'America Hatzafenis. What's that mean? Whoever hear of writing the name of a continent in a shtar? I never did. If you look carefully in the materials I gave you, I don't want to identify any further. We know exactly who did this and the year in which he did it. And the gentleman is referred to by Rabbi Yankiv Ettlinger in the Shem Ritzi and Hanemon as Meir Echod BeAmerika She'enu Yudea B'Tiv Gittin B'Kedushin. He was over here. Now he did it. And the printer is incorporated in the text. And they wrote America Tzvainis. Don't use a form that has America Tzvainis. It's not going to apostle anything, but it's not proper. Now, what people do is, and you'll hear it, this is the time of the year that I cringe just about every time I go to a wedding. It's weddings in Brooklyn, and I hear that it's so many, such and such a day, the Shabbos, such and such the Chodesh, the Minish on the Mon and Kan, and then it says Brooklyn, New York. Please tell me where I can find Brooklyn, New York. There is no city called Brooklyn, New York. There's a Brooklyn that is in Medinas, New York. And if you're going to do it, write Brooklyn to Medinas, New York. Now, we don't write the Shem HaMedina in a get. We don't write the Shem HaMedina in a ksuvah. I know we don't. If you'll ask me why, the short answer is, I don't know. That's what people do. The longer answer is, I read a reason in a sefer called the Nesivas HaHalacha that I wrote, so I can quote myself. We don't write the Shem HaMedina because the Shem HaMedina is subject to change very frequently, much more frequently than the Shem HaYir. We now call Czechoslovakia didn't exist before World War I, and there are cities in what was once upon a time Russia. Munkacs, for example. Where's Munkacs?
Ukraine
today. Once upon a time, Minkac was a Hungarian city. And if they were writing, it was written Lashiv in Medina Sogor. Now it's Hebrew for Hungary. But the later you have boundary changes and they incorporated. So nobody writes the Shem HaMedina. Alaska. It was in Russia or it was in America. Before Seward, it was Russia. Now it's America. And for the exchange of a few bucks, it was pretty cheap, what, $7,200,000. For that, you change the name of the country. And they didn't need this problem, so they didn't write the Medina altogether. It was enough to identify by the name of the city. But to have, call it the Shem HaYir, Brooklyn, New York, it's just not the name of the city. Yeah.
Can you write the word year?
I'm going to talk about that later. You either have to write ear or musa if you're doing it properly. We'll talk about that too. That's a separate issue. Yes.
Obviously, we don't do this, but why don't we just get rid of the decision by writing them in English?
Write in English, super! Well, first you have to learn how to translate it. And since I purposely told you to look at Rabbi Kellner's little sefer, I won't embarrass anybody by asking, and how many Zuzim or other coins when we're all finished is the Kal entitled to? You'll discover that it's not as clear as it may seem to be. So yeah, but you have to translate it properly and do whatever you like. They'll call me a heretic outside of this room, or maybe even in the room. But the text of the Ksuba was not given to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. Other things were, but the text of the Ksuba wasn't. And you could write a Ksuba in another language, would be absolutely kosher. But there's such a thing as, it's called tradition. I'll give you an example of this a little bit later if I come to it. But you write it in whatever the language of the Ksub is. I'm not sure I know what the language of the Ksub is. It's an amalgam. The language of the get is certainly an amalgam. It's one of the problems with the get. You can write in one language, you can write in two languages. And here's a little bit Aramaic and a little bit Hebrew. And say the Acharonim, it's called Voshna Talmudim. It's the language of the Talmudists. It's a new language. That's how we write it. Yeah. Not a get you can't write into language. Another star you can write into language. A get you don't write into language. Okay? Now, the net result of all of this is that to the extent that you have the cities, there's not going to be any problem with Mosek is Mosek. Your problem is going to be, and no June goes by where I don't get a phone call from somebody who's been Masada Kedushin someplace where, to the best of his knowledge, nobody ever performed a chuppah before. And now he's saddled with the problem of what am I going to write here? The problem is one, transliteration, and B, what's called a municipality for Prozalov and what isn't, and Yidden don't even talk about. Ksuba, you'll have to accommodate them one way or another. Now, I want to draw your attention to the Aruch HaShulchan, which is on pages 147, 148, 149. These aren't new problems. They were old problems. They existed long before. And he makes a number of points here. The first point he makes with regard to, he was Rovin Navardik, and Navardik had a suburb. It was called the Peretchike. And the issue was, do you write Peretchike would you write Nevardoch? And he says, Perechik is a separate city. You have to write Perechik. Well, the problem is that if you go 20 kilometers away, nobody ever heard of Perechik. And such Korean, you know, everybody thinks outside, they think it's part of Nevardoch. But in Nevardoch, everybody knows it's not Nevardoch. He solves that problem by saying you write Perechik hasmucho le Nevardoch. Then he deals with another problem, which is more frequent. Obviously, they change. Jews earned a living during this period by being innkeepers. In my Yiddish, at least, they called them kretschmers. Kretschmer in Yiddish, in Polish Yiddish, Lithuanian Yiddish, meant a bar. Now, the kretschmer in the old country was not like an American bar, but I don't know if you've ever been in England. You probably have, and you've seen pubs. What you probably don't realize is on top of the pub, there are rooms for rent. It was like an inn. And the medieval pubs all were inns where you spent the night, and you could get yourself a glass of beer or something stronger at the same time. And there were different clientels, the clientele that came to get drunk, and there were the wayfarers who spent the night upstairs. Now, the Jews ran these places. You probably don't remember, but it wasn't all that long ago when the 8th unlamented Cardinal Glemp accused Jews of making all the Poles drunkards because they sold them the whiskey. The problem is that everything he said was true. They would sell the whiskey. And they were appointed by the Poritz. They were given the monopoly. They paid rent to have this little monopoly. And Jews lived there and with their families. They weren't communities, but they had these places, and they were out there in the sticks. And every once in a while, particularly when somebody was deathly ill and couldn't travel for a get, so you had to be in the Saturday to get there. The problem was in the middle of no place, it's the crossroads. Now, again, I'll use Britain as the example. You know, if you've been to Britain, that every pub has a name. Some of them are named in more than one way. A name, the name's a reputation. Some of them are public houses of poor repute. Others of them, such as the King's Arms behind the Bodleian, nobody admitted without an IQ of 150. All the Oxford intelligentsia gather in the King's Arms. But if you want to make an appointment to talk to, you know, your professor in Oxford, he's more likely than not to tell you, "I'll see you in the King's Arms at 3 o'clock." That's how it was called. That's what it was called. Now these places in Poland, Lithuania, they also had names. They're Polish names instead of British names. And the Yerucha Shulchan says that you should write in the name of the put the name of the kretschmer. He says there's no Hebrew word for kretschmer. The word malon he didn't know, or pundik he didn't know. I don't know. He thinks it's not an accurate translation of what the word kretschmer means. He says you don't write in the hotel, whatever it is. Just write the hotel and the hasomuchlir, whatever it is. You have virtually the same thing in France, wherever Chateau has its name. I don't remember where it was published, but it was recently published. It was, I think even in Hamidia magazine, weekend magazine, a story about the late Rabbi Schneerson, a relative, not the same as the inhabitant of 770 Eastern Parkway. But this Rabbi Schneerson had all kinds of children's homes during the war that he saved hundreds of lives. And he was running these. These were, you know, not exactly public institutions in the sense that people were supposed to know about it. And they've got all the, you know, the thriller stories. But one of the places was located in Chateau, whatever the chateau was. It was in the middle of no place, didn't have a name. But every chateau had its name, like every kretschmer had its name, and every pub has its name. Now, he didn't have problems with regard to Gieten, that was Gieten Ksubis. That wasn't the problem, but that's the exact parallel to what the Aruch HaShulchan was talking about when he talks about the kretschmer. We have it too. We have it when we call them country clubs. And you've got a Burning Bush Country Club, which I know about only from the New York Times. That's apparently where all the people who otherwise are inside the Beltway, that's where they conduct their business. I have no idea whether it's in an incorporated municipality or it's got its own post office, but it could very well be a place which is the Times doesn't know it other than the country club, the Burning Bush Country Club, or whatever it's called. you could very well end up by writing such a place name in Exuba. And if you've got a hotel in the middle of no place, I think that the translation of hotel in Lashon Kodesh is Malon. And you would write Malon Hilton, Hasomuch, whatever it is, unless it's got its own little incorporated municipality, or it has a name by which it's known in the Jewish community. So that's the Aruch HaShulchan. Now, what if you have none of these things? Then you've got a problem, and we won't talk about that problem. But the real problem is that these places have a Shem, which is not a Shem Kodesh, it's a Shem Laz. And the issue is, how do you transliterate when you're spelling a Shem Laz? Now, it will be absolutely important to know how to transliterate in a number of different circumstances. Number one, when you're dealing with the name of the city. Number two, if you insist on writing the family name in the Ksuba, I strongly advise against writing the family name in the Ksuba. I see no reason for it in Halacha, and it's only buying yourself more problems, and you can easily possible the whole Ksuba. I know very well that there's a certain rabbinic organization that provides its members with Ksubas, and there's a little blank, Limishpachas, and you're supposed to fill it in. The only reason for even thinking about it is if you have two Yosef and Shimon who are Muchzak in the same city, in which case you need an additional Simon. Usually the Simon is the grandfathers. We generally don't have we have more than two Yosef and Shimons in the city, but they're not Muchzak as such. And unless, until it's Muchzak, not Muchzak to be Cheshish for it. And if you want to be Cheshish for it, put in grandparents' names. But if you're putting in the Shem HaMishpocha as a Simon, you better jolly well spell it correctly. I have been present at more than one chuppah where gedolim v'tovim from musmochim who are still wet behind the ears have made terrible mistakes in writing the ksuba. Things that can puzzle the ksuba in spelling the Shem HaMishpocha. Yeah?
But the family has multiple ways of spelling it.
How they spell the name is totally irrelevant, as we will discover. What is significant is how they pronounce the name.
Let's say they have multiple ways of
pronouncing it. Then you've got problems on your hands. We'll talk about that in a second. I can tell you one thing. There is a French name called Chouchet.
Okay.
Yes. And to spell it, Chouchet, Passel's excision, Lanier's Dike. The name is not Chouchet, the name is Suchet. Or Shuchay, however they pronounce it. It's not Shuchay. So transliterate it, but get it right. Now, that's egregious in the sense that whoever the Chochem is, he thinks that Shuchay and Shuchay is all the same things. All right, Shuchay. And that's it. But if you don't know the rules for transliteration, it is the easiest thing in the world to make a mistake. So that, you know, I'm just cautioning you. I'm warning you in advance. If you're going to insist on writing the Shem and Shvoche, then become proficient in the rules governing transliteration. Yes.
Rabbi said that if there's two Shimon, then you're saying it's Muchzak in the city. So how does that happen?
If you'll have two people in a shul, and they're both Reuven ben Shimon, and they each get the lias, and every time the Shamas says, Reuven ben Yama, Reuven ben Shimon, they look at each other and at the Shamas, which one does he mean? That's Muchzak Shnei Yisuf ben Shimon. In general, most people aren't aware of anybody else who has the same Hebrew name, to a large extent because you generally don't know your friend's patronyms. If you did, it might quickly become Muchzak, but generally people aren't aware of it, and it's not Muchzak, you're not the relationship, yes.
What did you hear in Shul say last week that actually happened? That I heard someone pray for the Holman, and they said my exact name, Ben, and they actually gave the wrong name, and instead of giving the mother the person speaking to the God, I gave the father's name, because I thought I needed that, and it was actually my name and my father's name, but it wasn't me.
Well, how many times did they make this Mishaberach? If they only made it once, I wouldn't worry. If the man is unfortunately chronically ill and you've been getting aliyahs constantly in that shul, at this point I think you should inform him about a kedushin that there's Muchzak Shnei Yosef B'Shimon in the city and let him worry about what to do afterwards. Yes, if there's two Muchzak Shnei Yosef B'Shimon, you have two Yosef B'Shimon. We'll worry about it then. Good. Now, the third case for which you must know this is the case I spoke about before. And that's when the Kala either doesn't have a Shem Kodesh, or you have for good reason decided not to use the Shem Kodesh. I will give you an autobiographical incident, my first chuppah. I assure you, I was more nervous than either the chosn or the kala. And it was at a time when I was learning Chelo, and I kept body and soul together with a weekend shtela someplace in New Jersey, and I had a chuppah. The parents of both the chosn and the kala lived in town. I had never seen them before. They never came to shul. But they came from Jewish families, nice Jewish families. And of course, you have a prenuptial interview. And among the things I asked them were the names. And we made sure to get all the names down right. And then comes the chuppah, and we're sitting at one big table before the chuppah, and there's a grandmother on one side and an aunt on the other side. Just to make sure, I asked the grandmother, "Und wie heißt er enikol as ein jüdischer Namen?" Now, what's his Jewish name? And he tells me his Jewish name is Shloime. And the aunt, who is sitting at the other side of the table, starts screaming, or whatever. And these two women already pull out each other's hair about what the name they gave the bris was. One says it was after my whatever it was, the other says after my whatever it is. And first I had to keep the peace. But when I finished with all of this, it was nobody else remembers anything. Except the kid who told me one of the two. I mean, where'd he hear it from? He heard it from his grandmother, probably. When it's all over, I finished. I tore up what I had written, and I had a second suba, and I proceed to fill it in. And I make a mistake because I'm nervous enough. I need this over on my head. So I had to tear that one up too, and I didn't have a third blank. So I begin laboriously writing the text of the suba. The president of the shul, this type doesn't exist anymore. He was the old school shul president, whatever that means, for good and for bad. He comes over to me and says, "Was tut der Rebbe?" I told him, "Schreib aksuba." He looks at me and says, "Schreib, what did you get for?" So yeah, I told him that it was a problem, the names, the one says it's this thing, that's the second name, so I tear up the old one, and I'm writing a new one. So he looks at me, he was smart enough to say, "Und wie wird ihr schreiben?" Now what are you writing here? So I told him his English name was, make things complicated. His name was Stephen, and he spelled it S-T-E-P-H-E-N. So we have one Shem HaKriya, another Shem HaKsiva. Fortunately, I knew enough how to handle that. But I tell him I'm writing Stephen. So he asks me another follow-up question. "Und wie wird ihr lehnen unter der Chuppe?" What are you going to read? I tell him, "Ich lehne diese Stadt." I read what it says. So he looks at me and said, "Wird einfach sagen, als ihr seid a Reform Rabbi." Got to translate? They'll say you're a Reform Rabbi. My response was, halavai. The halavai was because I had all kinds of trouble with this family until that point about other things that I had to insist on that wasn't exactly the kind of thing that a liberal clergyman would be insisting upon. But there was no choice except to write the Shem Arisa. I don't think this is such a terrible b'dievet. It can be even l'chatchila. I know other people who would have l'chatchila written Stephen and not Shlomo or Shmuel under those circumstances, and we have that all the time in Ksivas Yitin. I had another case many years afterwards, a second marriage. A person came to me with a p'tur. The first p'tur had only an English name, and when I wrote the ksuba, I wrote the Hebrew name. And I met the Masader Haget, who was a very respected rav, at a wedding afterwards, and I asked him if he remembers, and I said, "Yes." I told him, "You didn't write the Shem Aris, you didn't write the Shem Kodesh." And he said, "Of course not, the El was Nishtaka." The name they gave him was the Bris, nobody called him by that name, nobody used the name, he used it as Bar Mitzvah, and maybe in the Ksuba when he got married, among the Glitz Ek Shakom Chsidish, in those crowds, that is considered to be Nishtaka. In the crowds that followed the Olei Shem and the Binyan Tzion, they weren't Lithuanians, but the Litv Shalom follows the practice, that is the Shem Aris is not Mishdakach, if anybody remembers it, that the name which is, as the Yoruch HaShulchan puts it, is given the Dvorim Shebekdusha, including the get. It's given for religious purposes, and that's called not called Mishdakach. I had the advantage that between the get and the second marriage, they sent out in the wedding invitations that happened to have the Hebrew name also. So that even if it was once Nishtakach, I think that it was or Chayza Veneer, it now became known on the basis of the invitations alone. But the three reasons, those are the three reasons I gave you why you must know how to transliterate, or at least to be mistapik v'shoyel, to know what it is that you have to clarify. And that's when you have a Shem Meir you're stuck with, or a Shem Mishpoch if you insist on using it, or a case in which there are problems with the Shem Kodesh, and in Exuv you don't write more than one name. Don't hesitate to use the Shem Laz rather than the Shem Kodesh whenever you have shaylus on the Shem Kodesh, but make sure you know how to spell it. You don't write the mystery and the Shem Kodesh together with this, and again, you have more problems because you have to include this, you have to know how to spell it when you're including it. You can't just include it and not know the proper name that you're including. But in the terms of Ksuv, it's easy enough. You ignore the other Shem, and you write the Shem Laz. Yes?
There are Sephardim that talk about this.
No, that's the problem. The only Sefer that I know about transliteration is the Sefer that I gave you, the little pamphlet of Rav Henkin. And he has lists of names and the rules. That's for Ashkenazim. Sfardim, maybe we'll talk about a little bit next time. I went way over time. But anyway, 2 weeks from today, Mr. Hashem, we continue.